This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Good afternoon. I'm Michael McKernan, and this is Jeff Pryor. But I guess you worked that out. Well, you didn't work out I was Michael McKernan, but you worked out he was Jeff Pryor. I don't review the books of friends. I think it's a very sensible principle to operate on, because you'll never tell the truth. They happen to be friends. How could the book be bad? And I don't have conversations with my friends publicly, except today. Geoffrey and I have been friends since we met in delightful circumstances on the way to Gallipoli for the return of those Australian veterans of the Gallipoli campaign who were returned by the Australian government in 1990. And my good friend Bill Gammage, who's in the audience, said to me, "Oh, I know somebody else going on that trip." And I said, "Who's that?" And he said, "Geoffrey Pryor." And I said, "Ah," and I knew that Geoffrey was the cartoonist for the Canberra Times, because I'd been living in Canberra for quite some time already. And Bill Gammage said, "He's quite a nice bloke." And so I thought, "Oh, well, that's a head start, I suppose." So I was travelling with the artist Clifton Pugh, and we got onto the plane and found our seats and sat down. And the fellow in front of us was Geoffrey Pryor, and he turned around and he introduced himself. It took the organisers longer to get the plane loaded with the old gentleman, because the oldest of them turned 102 on Anzac Day, so they weren't spring chickens. It took them somewhat longer than they'd anticipated to get them on the plane, so the plane sat on the ground for quite some time. And another cartoonist in the union of cartoonists spotted Mr. Pryor sitting there and came along very surreptitiously to him and leant over and whispered something to us. I didn't know he was a cartoonist. He was just, to my way of thinking, he was a Qantas steward.
Which he was.
Which he was.
Yes.
And he was a part-time cartoonist. Mark Lynch.
Yes.
Mark Lynch. And he whispered something to Geoffrey. And Geoffrey turned around and said, "And for my two friends too." And then I realised that cartoonists were the sort of people I liked, because Mark Lynch was suggesting that a drink could be had before the plane took off, because it was such a long time in getting off. And that's the first and only time I've ever been on a 747 and drinking before we even had wheels up. So I decided that Mark Lynch was obviously a good bloke, and Bill Gammage had said that Geoffrey Pryor was a good bloke, and he turned out to be a good bloke, and we travelled the Gallipoli Peninsula together in great awe, I think. And then we have travelled together in a journey around conversations for quite some time. So when I was asked would I converse with Geoffrey Pryor, I said, "What's new?" So now here's Geoffrey Pryor. I've made my confession. Geoffrey, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Michael.
Yeah. See? This is an animated conversation.
Short, snappy intros.
Yes. Geoffrey retired after 30 years at the Canberra Times in February of this year. Is that correct?
That's right.
Yes. And here we are celebrating those 30 years, and some of the work that Geoffrey has done is on display further down the hallway. And I was looking at it as we walked along here, and it's just delightful to see people standing in front of your work, some of which we're seeing behind us, and chuckling. And I thought to myself, it must be a very rich life that gives someone the opportunity of doing something that makes people feel better about the world on a daily basis. Is that how you saw it?
Well, yes, I did. I always drew them for the readers rather than for the subjects, the politicians. I always felt it was for the benefit of the readers. I'd gone through lots of agony and struggles within to unknot complicated political issues to be able to, you know, render them in drawings. I sort of hope that the reader would perhaps appreciate the process and maybe come to similar conclusions from, you know, looking at the drawings.
Now, describe. You were working for the bulk of your working life. You were doing 7 cartoons a week.
Yes.
Which is unlike, I think, any other Australian cartoonist in a major metropolitan paper. Most of them would do 5 or 6.
That's right. Well, I was Muggins. Newspapers, like any other form of media, are desperate for content, and Muggins volunteered for it. So that's how it happened. The Sunday one evolved into a large panel which took up half of a whole broadsheet page, which was a summary of the week's events. And that became tortuous over time because not much could be happening during the week, but that space still had to be filled, and indeed that was the same with any working day.
Yeah. Now just describe your working day. How did we get a drawing next day to look at, chuckle over and be enriched by?
I could say a lot of prayer, but that wasn't the case. I'd start the day normally at about 6 a.m. with the first news bulletins on ABC, and our house has radios in just about every room, and as I sort of progress through the house making coffee or going to the bathroom, whatever, another radio would be switched on, so I could have this continuous unbroken stream of radio news. It always took me about 3 or 4 bulletins to be fully conscious of them, but it was a slow process. But it was just picking up on what had happened the previous evening, what was developing for the day. That would be followed over breakfast and after breakfast by a couple of newspapers, which I get delivered at home. Then listening to hourly bulletins. I'm a complete news junkie. I got to the stage where I could, some inner clock would make me reach out and turn on the radio during the day, and I get the ABC news theme right on the hour. I just knew, you know, it would just happen. Then the world today at lunchtime, and then into work in the afternoon, say about 2 or 3. Talking to people then, having a long chat with Jack Waterford, my editor and then senior editor, about issues, events happening in the world, trying to pin a few things down. And I reckon by about 5 or 6 in the afternoon, I'd be starting to try and put an idea together in my head. I knew that was about the time. It'd be no little point in starting before then, because often, if I had an idea too early in the day, the news could change throughout the day, and I'd be left with an idea, a drawing, which I'd have to...
Did you ever have to do that, to just pull one out?
Yes, I did. I had to... at first, when the news changed, I had to throw it away if I'd drawn it. Sometimes I grew smarter in time, and I realised if I could just change it from a positive to a negative and maybe to still use the original idea, but just change, just tweak it slightly. But the rule of the day, I think, working in the media, you know, you discover that the news is fixed by about 6 in the evening if the politicians are in control, because that means that, you know, they've got time for their presses, their press conferences, for the electronic journalists to make their packages up for their evening bulletins, and for the ABC a little bit later, and indeed, you know, for the print media. If the news was breaking after that, 6 or 7 or 8 in the evening, then it was a pretty clear indication that events were out of control of the politicians. It might mean a leadership spill or whatever. And so, you know, you would be in for a late night, but a fun night, because these are nights of high drama.
Yeah.
And they were fun. This is what working for a newspaper was all about, late breaking news.
Yeah.
You know, if somebody got assassinated or something, the Pope died or anything, you know, of note happened. There's one occasion where people didn't mind being woken up in the middle of the night to come back in and put out a special edition. This was the essence of working for a newspaper.
Now, you didn't work out of Parliament House?
I gave it a lot of thought at one stage. I was going to lift everything from my office at work and go over there. I felt that there was an advantage of being there, but that would have been the old Parliament House, and it was just hopelessly tight for space. I didn't see much advantage later on in the new house. In fact, it was easier to stay back at Fyshwick, although I'd occasionally wander into the house and see the animals in the zoo, so to speak, see them in the flesh, which is very useful, because you get to see body shapes. You get to see, if you're sitting above looking down, you get to see who is becoming tonsorially disadvantaged over time. I remember Paul Keating looking down, and Paul would be doing a lot of this. And I think I took a little bit of delight, which I was perfectly entitled to indicating this in my drawings with little arrows pointing to his bald spot.
Yes, you did that. That was a cruel part of your...
But I felt, you know, well, why not? I mean...
So when you say drawing Keating or Hawke or Howard, you're not, in that case, you weren't drawing from life, were you? You're drawing from a memory you, or photographs yes. you have of them or something like that, because you're not at Parliament House.
I always started off with photos to build up a caricature, a likeness. And to me, with my style, the likeness was the key thing. I couldn't see the point of doing a convoluted drawing, trying to make a point if nobody can recognise the people in it.
So no,
they had to look like the characters. Sometimes some were not quite as close to the mark as others, but there was always a genuine attempt to get that likeness. And I'd start off with a photo, and then hopefully after the first outing with the photos, we have an extensive pictorial library just next door to where I worked, and of course now there's Google Image, so there's no shortage of resources. I would throw the photo away and work from the memories of those first drawings, and then it would be a process of working from the memory of that and the memory of that. And it was a good thing to do, get away from the photos, because caricatures were always evolving things.
Well, they all grew, didn't they? I mean, Howard grew uglier and uglier.
Well, they all grew uglier.
The bottom lip got bigger and bigger.
That's right. That's right. And that became a challenge in a way, because it got so, it was such a dominant and recognisable feature that it had to dwarf other parts of the face in the physical drawing of it, so gradually the chin vanished altogether. But yes, this happened with all political, or most politicians, particularly leaders, because they age in front of your eyes. It's a bit like the boiling frog.
So were you constantly updating them?
Not constantly, but I'd be alert for little changes. Changes in... I noticed with somebody like Hawke, he developed a little bit of a dowager's hump over time. He scrawned down even. And he became smaller and wiry. He sort of lost a little bit of his sort of athletic springiness. But I think it's the life that they lead, you know. Their appointment books are filled years in advance. I think they'd never get enough sleep.
Yep.
Always under stress or pressure of some sort, or they should be. I don't know, I think Ronald Reagan had people who he transferred stress to.
I remember looking at photographs of airmen who flew over Europe in the memorial collection and looking at their drawn and tight and taut faces and how old they looked. And then looking at men, those same men, say 6 months after they'd finished flying in war, and how much younger they looked. And the same thing, it seemed to me, happened with Malcolm Fraser. Malcolm yes. Fraser, by the end of his prime ministership, looked terribly old, didn't he?
Yes. Yes, he did.
And he was your first prime minister?
Yes.
Yeah. Let's go back to the start, Geoffrey. You were born in Canberra.
Yes. Born, raised, educated in Canberra.
Right. And so from an early age, so about 5, 6, you said to yourself, I am going to be the cartoonist on the Canberra Times. That is my life's ambition. That is where all my education is leading me, and my whole direction of life is that. It was a brave decision, wasn't it?
It's a brave story too. I'd always drawn. That was the part that was always with me. It was in my genes.
What does that mean? Were you drawing rural scenes, or
I was drawing people? The human form.
Your mum and dad, your brothers and sisters?
Fictitious people. I could fill a whole page with mouths or with ears or with eyes. And people doing things. I was particularly taken by sports people, you know, in action. And it was just something that had seized me from the very beginning. So I'd never frightened of ever drawing a figure in a cartoon. They were like plastic models. I could make them do. I felt that I could make them perform whatever physical action that the idea, the metaphor required of them.
You just picked up a pencil or a pen and you knew you could draw.
Well, that's the way it felt. It was a sort of a natural connection between mind and hand. I struggled and got frustrated when
were you
it didn't
taught?
Work out.
Did
no.
you have art lessons?
No. No. But I did have a grandfather who was a cartoonist.
And this was talk important. A bit about your grandfather.
Oswald Pryor lived in Adelaide, and he had been born and raised in Moonta, which is in the Copper Triangle on the York Peninsula near in the big copper loads, the copper mines in that area, Wallaroo and so forth. And he had a drawing talent, and he became a cartoonist in his own right, and became quite well known depicting the Cornish community in Moonta, of which there was quite a few. In fact, in his later life and after, became better remembered in Cornwall than he did in Australia. But at that time, when he was living in Adelaide after about 1920, he was actually drawing for the old Red Cover Bulletin.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a South Australian agent for the Bulletin. And he swapped cartoons with his confreres of the time, David Lowe, Lindsay, Souter, and these old artists from the Bulletin days, as we do, cartoonists today. I've got a collection of my contemporaries at home. And when, on the rare occasions that I visited Adelaide, I would look at these cartoons on his wall, particularly a low one, and I would look at it and just look at it and think, I wonder if I'll ever be able to draw like that. It was just so brilliant in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that fixed something deep inside that that pushed me along.
Nature or nurture?
Bit of both.
Bit of both, yeah.
Yes.
So do you think the ability to draw is inherited?
Well, I think, people who teach other people to use the other side of their brains will say that anybody can draw.
Right.
And I think that they can. If they follow these programs, they learn a new way of looking at things, not allow the brain to interfere, but just to try and express what they observe.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, they can. But it's a bit like playing a musical instrument. Some people say they'll never learn. They've got a tin ear. They've got no musical ability.
Mm.
But if they battle away, they'll play, chopsticks on a piano or something.
It's said some people can't sing.
I gather so, yes.
You began at the Canberra Times in 1978.
Yes.
So there's a bit of a gap. And
yes.
So you went to the ANU, and then you were overseas for a while.
Well, I did my first public drawings at the ANU as a failing undergraduate in the 60s. I was a law student, which is about the worst possible thing I could have been. I used to pay my way to faculty balls by doing caricatures of the faculty staff.
Uh-huh.
And these were hung up, done on butcher's paper, and hung up around the walls, with all the decorations. And these were sort of pinched or sold off during the evening. But my payment was to attend and all the booze I could handle, I guess. That was
free ticket.
Free and free provender.
Oh,
yes.
What a very nice life. So you could see that obviously this was going to be an enriching activity, this cartooning caper.
And around about that time also I freelanced at the Canberra Times as a press artist, which didn't involve much freehand drawing, but it involved doing things like putting the names of racehorses in the photos, the finishing line photos.
Oh, yeah.
Drawing maps. Yeah.
Oh, right.
And I remember the pictorial editor at the time had a penchant for doctoring photos, which I did because I was told to, but these days I'd have very serious doubts about things like, Jeff, I think we need to get rid of this person in the photo because they don't add anything to it. So I was using tone paints, which were a water-based paint in shades of grey, I would paint the bricks of the house behind over this person.
Gee, I could swear I was standing next to my wife.
Right. Well,
she's there, but where the hell am I?
Well, you were, weren't you? but that's a process that raises ethical questions.
Yeah.
But then when I dropped out of uni and was a little bit in disarray about where my future lay, that's when I decided to go overseas.
Let's skip the time in Canada.
Yes.
And so you came back to Australia. Mm-hmm. Now, how did you go from coming back to Australia to becoming the Canberra Times cartoonist?
Well, the time in Canada is important because my brother would write to me.
We won't skip the time in Canada.
No, I need to say this. He wrote to me on one occasion to say that Larry Pickering had left the Canberra Times. If I wanted to, you know...
To go to the Australian... Way. Did Pickering go to the
National Times.
National Times.
He'd stayed. The Canberra Times was Fairfax, so he moved within the Fairfax stable to the National Times and after to the Australian.
So your brother wrote to you and said there is an opening.
Well, said that this Pickering bloke, he'd been sending me his cartoons. Yeah. Said he's really good and popular. He said, but he's leaving. And I'd expressed an interest in making a career out of it then. And it was then I formed the ambition to come back to Canberra and become the cartoonist on the Canberra Times, which is a pretty daring sort of thing to do, because if I bombed, it was going to be pretty public in the place where I was born and raised.
But when you got that slot, and there's that space in the paper every day that has to be filled, you really didn't have a huge body of work behind you or that had been published?
I had freelanced as an illustrator for a couple of years while I was doing a BA at the ANU, and that work grew and grew because the more they started to rely on it, and it really started to impinge on my studies. Then I was a mature age student at that stage.
Right.
But when I graduated finally in 78, 1978, I said to Ian Matthews, who was the editor then, I said, "I need a job, and you need a cartoonist. How about it?" And thankfully, he said yes. And I think there was something about my style that he liked. There was something a bit English about it. You know, there was a lot of drawing, a bit like Giles or some of the cartoonists there.
Now, do you think it's easier to be a cartoonist in Canberra to an audience that is perhaps more politically alert than it would be in places where politics aren't the, you know, sort of part of the way we live?
Well, that's a very interesting point because it was precisely that which gave me so much pain and agony when I was starting, always trying to pitch my comments at a level which I thought needed to be sophisticated enough for the Canberra reader.
Right.
Canberrans are most highly educated people in the country, the most knowledgeable, the most newspaper reading. I mean, they're... I drive through any of the inner suburbs, you can see several tree trunks lying on people's driveways on a Saturday morning in the form of rolled up newspapers. Getting hold of the policy issues that I was trying to comment on and getting the right handle on them, understanding them, it was important to me that... That I wasn't being too crude or pitching it at too lower a level.
I remember we've got good friends in Sydney, and from time to time when Moira was on leave, you were also in the Sydney Morning Herald.
Yes.
And this is before they became good friends of yours. And they used to say, Geoffrey Pryor's cartoons, they're interesting, but I don't always get them. And it seemed to, because they're intelligent people, you know who I'm talking about, but it seemed to me that there was a difference in perception. You know, in Canberra, you could do things that were perhaps, you know, we're all in the know a bit, or is that taking it too far?
Can you give me their names? One of the things about being born and growing up in Canberra, being educated here, I had friends who had progressed through the bureaucracy and in areas, some of them were, you know, in fairly sort of hothouse policy development areas. I know I had one in defence, and I could ring him up at different times when I felt that I needed more information. I remember a certain person I would ring up if there was an issue involving the war memorial. His brains I would pick.
Yes. Well, there never were. It was a quiet, restful backwater.
But there was this... I had this advantage of proximity, expertise, which I wouldn't have had in somewhere else, Sydney or Melbourne, and it's something I valued very much.
Very it's very difficult to wander down a street or be in a restaurant with Geoffrey because somebody will know him on about a 5-minute basis and come over and talk to him. We were having lunch in a restaurant in Manuka out on the footpath the other day, and a bloke came over and I thought to myself, oh yeah, here we go again, you know, hi Geoff, how are you? And we'll have 15 minutes on being at school together and all that sort of stuff. And Geoffrey didn't know this bloke from a bar of soap, but what he wanted to talk to Geoffrey about was that hat and where he bought it, because he said it's a jolly fine hat. The only time I've been out with Geoffrey when it wasn't a friend who had interrupted the conversation. Just do a few issues, Geoffrey, and then we might open it up to people to raise questions with you and join in the conversation. The first one that has always struck me, and I think it's even more prominent now than it has been thanks to the deputy leader of the Liberal Party, and that's a question of plagiarism. People talk about plagiarism much more now, don't mm-hmm. they, than they used to. But it seems to me that given that there's only a very few cartoonists on metropolitan papers, that one of the things you'd have to be very wary of was looking at other people's work too much mm-hmm. because it could shape, or, you know, a gag that they did might be a gag you wanted to use or could shape your thinking about an issue. How much were you alert to the dangers of plagiarism?
I was alert to that. Mm. I rigorously checked the other newspapers. We didn't file them all on our stack, but enough of them. And I remember on one occasion, I think it was a Friday, when I was desperate to get out, I was tired after a long week, and as a last gasp, going over to the stack to see what a cartoonist from another paper had done, I'd seen all the others, and he had already used the idea that I was going to use in our paper the next day. So I had to rip up my idea.
And start again?
Yeah, start again.
Did it ever happen that quite unintentionally two of you had done the same thing?
Yes. I remember I followed David Rowe and myself did almost identical cartoons. I think it was Clinton's second inauguration and he's taking the oath. And the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court is leaning towards him and saying to him, sotto voce, your fly's undone. And we both had the same cartoon. The problem was that David had his on the Tuesday and I had mine on the Wednesday, and I just hadn't seen the financial review, so this was an accident. And what I did was to ring him up.
Yep.
And apologise. And explained that it was a mistake, and of course David didn't care at all. He's that sort of bloke. And mostly people don't, because I don't believe that there's deliberate plagiarism. Mm. I think what happens is that there's only a set number of metaphors that are floating around to yep. describe a situation, and people just happen to hit on the same metaphor. And I know I had phone calls over the years, and this voice on the other end, I pick up the phone, this voice would say, snap, and it'd be Alan Moyer, who had chosen exactly the same metaphor and theme for his cartoon that day.
Yeah. Are you all good friends? I mean, is it a sort of club?
Yes. Cartoonists, I think, we're a bit like warriors. We share the same stretch of trench. We go through the same anxieties, the same pressures of deadline, and so you know, when we get together, we've got war stories. Okay. You know, we exchange war stories. Mm-hmm. There's very little bitchiness that goes on. Perhaps about enough that warrants people in a creative profession.
Yeah.
But in get-togethers like the Black and White Artists Society annual award functions and things, I think they're remarkable for the friendliness mm-hmm. amongst everybody. And the interesting thing is that because of styles, excuse me, different levels of understanding, different approaches, everybody comes in laterally from their own level, their own angle. So nobody's better than anybody else. We're just different.
Yeah, yeah. But, yeah, different, very different in styles
yes.
sometimes.
Yes, and type of comment.
Yeah.
You see, a good example is some subjects are obligatory, like budget yep. day. And there are lock-ups all over the country, and cartoonists go in along with the journalists and have to sort of dream up a comment. And it's a very anxious time because, you know, you've got this document and lots of fact. And the first question is, do I attempt to globalise the comment and try and encapsulate the whole of the budget document and all of its thrust, or do I sort of pick on one part here, you know, whether it's a tariff change or whatever the issue might have been, and do I focus on that? And the next day you could go around the nation's press and just see what all the cartoonists had done and the way that they'd had approached it. And whether they had...
Would they all be in the lock-up? Do they come to Canberra for that?
No, they have their own lock-ups in their capitals. Oh, okay. I could always rely on Peter Nicholson. He would always come. Mm-hmm. I think it was a good chance to get away from their, you know, their office.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
a bit of a junket, and there's a good nosh-up at the end of the day.
Is there?
Oh, yes, yes.
So you're only really in it for the food?
Oh, yes.
And drink?
Absolutely, absolutely, yeah.
The second issue is a question of good taste. Mm-hmm. Now, you are, and so many people in the audience would know you, you are a very kind and a very generous man. You're a good father and a wonderful husband. I think all these things go without saying. But you can be the meanest bastard on the face of the earth. Now, you know, when, say, somebody like Paul Keating, who relentlessly you drew as the Sun King,
yes,
who got more extravagant with the periwig, as yes. You thought he got more arrogant... Yes. How do you then sort of meet him in Abel's record store in Manuka and say, oh, good day, Paul? You know,
tentatively. the smarter ones or the wiser ones know that it goes with the territory, it's the job. As for taste, I love bad taste of the Monty Python sort. If it's intelligent bad taste, I can't get enough of it. I was quite happy to censor myself for prurience, and I was always conscious that it was a family newspaper. There's no point in trying to get past the editor on those sorts of issues, although I think I did try on one or two occasions if I thought the idea was good enough. But, for instance, Peter Nicholson did the one that everybody still talks about, Gough and Margaret in China, yeah. When the earthquake happened. Darling, did the earth move for you? I mean, that's one of the Australian classics. Well, yeah. I wouldn't hesitate with a cartoon like that to try and sneak that one past. It's such a damn good idea. Yeah. But with taste generally, always found it awkward in watching out for gratuitously insulting people. Mm-hmm. Although I must admit I was a little bit... a little bit slack at times on other people's religious beliefs. I remember getting into trouble for drawing a cartoon after India exploded their atomic bomb of Ganesh, raising an arm to the world with the elephant's head and with the trunk straight up too. And I got criticised for mocking the Hindu religion.
Oh.
And that's something that hadn't occurred to me. I mean, I had always... To me, to my callow mind, always thought that the figure of Ganesh, a human with an elephant's head, was slightly absurd.
Yeah.
But they don't think so.
Right. one of the things that every cartoonist will have to deal with is the death of a celebrity or
yes.
a political leader, or death is something that you're always going to comment on.
Death and disaster.
Death yes. and disaster. Your method with death often was to have the pearly gates
yes.
and St. Peter
yes.
and, you know, scroll out and, you know, sins and omissions to be registered, good things done. That's, you know, because there will be families in grief when somebody's died.
Yes.
That would be an issue of taste, wouldn't there? There'd
yes.
be some things that you'd have to pull back on. I mean, we don't need to go to Billy Snedden, but you have an idea of what
yes.
I'm thinking about.
Well, I call those ones the pearly gaiters, where somebody, a celebrity or somebody well up in the public eye, I think those comments could be made without too much worry, because they are people who've put themselves as performers or politicians or whatever, in the public eye. They've done it all their lives and mm-hmm. have benefited from it in one way or another. So, you know, their death shouldn't go unremarked in the same way.
Perhaps. Yeah, but sometimes that's not quite the case, is it? I mean, say, a literary figure, I don't know. Did you do a cartoon, a Pearly Gator, when Manning Clark died, for example?
I probably did, but I remember one of the last I did was of Marceau, the mime. And he's standing at the entrance, and the St. Peter's saying, "Well, Marcel Marceau." He's going through the register. "Well, why didn't you say so?" And to me, you know, that's not... there was one I didn't get to draw because I was away at the time, but when Kerry Packer died, I was going to do the funeral scene with an enormous coffin, maybe, you know, five stories high, and somebody saying, in the congregation saying, "He's taking it with him." And I never got to draw it, but I would have drawn that. And I wouldn't have let the taste worry me. Where the taste is difficult is something that is of immense tragedy. You know, maybe September the 11th, the Trade Towers. Cartoonists have different ways of dealing with those. There are those who do the mawkish ones. You know, I think New York with endless cartoons of the Statue of Liberty with the tear rolling down the cheek and so forth, which I couldn't come to. I can't remember what I did, but I think it had a slightly political edge. But I think one of the hardest, most difficult ones in those circumstances were the Tasmanian Port Arthur Massacre, where the tally just kept... I turned it into a gun issue.
Did you?
And just had a silhouette of a military assault rifle with... I can't remember the context, but I kept adding to them as the body count kept rising through the night. And it was meant to be a telling comment, and it was meant to be serious, but funnily enough, the problem with doing these sorts of cartoons is that there are readers out there who don't have a different understanding of the role of the cartoonist.
Yeah.
And they think it's to make a gag or a funny joke out of the day's proceedings, and for a cartoonist to even begin to address an issue like that, they think it's disgraceful and bad taste, just on those grounds alone.
On that alone,
On that alone.
I suppose religion, religion, sex, they're all likely to be questions of taste, aren't they? One of my favourite cartoons of yours is, I think it was probably even in the Sunday morning paper, during the bushfires, and you had... And I think it arose from your own experience. You and Jan, I know, went off to see what you could do at the evacuation centres.
Yes.
And you had a drawing of Canberra people streaming into, like, a hall at Narrabundah or something.
That's
like
right.
Carrying mattresses and food and helping out. And I can't remember what the tagline
was. I think the tagline was the soul of Canberra. No, Canberra, the soul of city,
And it was and I mean, you must have done that like that. I mean, you wouldn't have had, nobody had time that night for anything much more than concern for their own family and concern for the city. So that must have been a terribly difficult one to do, and yet you got it so right.
Well, that was the, trying to find the right line, you know, the right... point at which to come in, and I'd been down, I think that on the Saturday night at Narrabundah College, and we took a couple of bits of bedding down. I think they were desperate for mattresses, and we had a bit lying around at home.
Yep.
We took it down, and I was just amazed, just astounded at the at people just streaming in, carrying stuff and mattresses and blankets and bottled water, everything that they could manage, and this was such a counter impression to what people were saying about the city and what Paddy McGuinness
famously said very shortly afterwards. So in your role on the Canberra Times, how much did you think you should be involved in local issues as against national politics?
This was always a problem for me. I tried to maintain a mix of international, national and local. And funnily enough, international really meant American. They were about the only international politics, apart from wars, in which we were involved, but that involved the Americans too. But the American politics were the only international politics which impinged on our own. one rarely commented on goings on in Britain, mm-hmm. whereas there was a time when that would have been the major focus. Nationally, well, that was the main game, of course. Locally, I always tended to overlook it. I just always found it difficult to, make the effort to sort of lift the lid. That was my fault. I'd always regarded the Assembly as a bit of a sheltered workshop, which was unfair because it's not at all. I mean, there's a huge budget at play there, and it's important, but it's very difficult to come to grips with it. David Pope seems to have no problem. I saw he did a very nice drawing during the week of a young coalition's or young opposition's maiden speech, which I wouldn't have bothered with, but he did a good job.
It was a very powerful cartoon, wasn't it?
Yes.
I mean, he was extraordinarily critical.
Yes, yes.
Which gets on to the next issue, thank you. We're rolling along through the issue.
We're segueing nicely. Yes.
Do you reckon your readers, what do we call them, your viewers?
Readers.
Your readers.
Yes. Certainly not audience.
Okay.
Or the audience. They keep talking about, the media's audience.
Do you think they would know or think they knew your political opinions?
Pretty much, I think. I tried to kid myself that I was being neutral, and I was trying to leave the reader guessing. I think on some issues I succeeded, perhaps, but there's not much chance because a cartoonist is in the position of being a paid knocker, a professional knocker, and I'm paid to be against the government. Uh-huh. I was paid to be against the government. That was my job. And I used to worry about balance. And the editor said, oh, don't worry, it'll balance out over time, over years, and it did.
Mm.
But when you have a government of one persuasion in power for 11 years, people are going to take the view that you're pretty left-wing because you seem to want to hammer it every day.
Yeah. Mm. No, but not necessarily your opinions, then.
Largely, I think, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I think I settled down into my my position in the political spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
Stopped worrying about it.
But how do cartoonists get away with it? Because I mean, it's inconceivable that you could have been on the ABC, because then the question of balance would come in very much more heavily.
Well, Philip Adams.
The rest of the ABC. Oh, it doesn't matter.
I know. Yeah, point taken.
Yeah. But did people ring you up? I mean, it is said that if Paul Keating, a journalist wrote a critical piece of about Keating, he would ring up and blast the bloke for 45 minutes or whatever. I think Alan Ramsey was writing about that last weekend. Did people ring you up and say, I don't look anything like that? I wouldn't ever say that or do that? Or do they all just go along with the gag?
I think they go along with it. I don't think politicians pay much attention to the content of cartoons. That's my own opinion. A cartoon's never going to change any political minds.
Well, but it can, can't it? I mean, look at Norman Lindsay's cartoons in the First World War. He shaped the way Australians thought of the Hun.
Mm. Well, I think they shaped the readers. Who shaped the politicians. That's my own feeling. I always felt that I never got very much feedback from the political leaders at all.
Didn't you?
I got a request once from Keating, once or twice. I remember one cartoon. I did a series of him and Hawke as the Blues Brothers. And it seemed to be...
The Blues Brothers.
It just seemed to be a natural fit. And he wanted the original, the first one. I used to get requests from Ian Sinclair for originals.
Right.
He was a bit of an old tart cartoon collector.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't mind because he was such a... the worse I tried to make them, the keener he was to get the original.
So they couldn't go into the National Museum or the National Library and be on display forever.
But you see, politicians are in an invidious position here because they can't afford to complain, certainly not of being offended. because, you know, if they ring you up and say, oh, I didn't like that, I thought that was most unfair and I didn't like the way you drew me, well, the obvious riposte is, well, I'm terribly sorry I offended you. I'll make sure I don't do one of you again. Oh, no, very valid. I didn't mean it.
Yeah. There's a section in the annual show here of the cartoons for the year. There's a section, the first section I think in that show is, Sorry He's Left Us, which is, cartoonists regretting the demise of Howard because he was such a drawable person.
Yes.
They say that, you know, all cartoonists, particularly in Victoria, but possibly around Australia, went into, you know, 6 months grief when Henry Bolte retired because he was, you know, the obvious person to caricature. Who was the person you least liked drawing and who was the person you most liked drawing?
The least liked were the youngest politicians. I can't think of any individual, but the ones who were so young that they hadn't been around long enough to develop character in their presence. And somebody like Michael Lee comes to mind, somebody who Jack Waterford described as having risen without a trace. And, it wasn't original, but it was very apt.
Yeah.
I always had trouble coming into grips with a face like that.
Why? Because there just aren't the lines in it,
that's
or
right.
The angularity?
And there's not the angularity of personality either. It's also the persona. When you're drawing people, you have to deal with sort of issues which are difficult. They're sort of abstract concepts. For example, stature. Talking about a person's stature, and that means his presence or her presence to others, how people see them, their level of standing within their political community. And stature is it's an abstract concept. How do you do it? Well, quite simply, if you don't think they have much stature, you draw them small. And in the same way, if you want to, even in the sort of the cartoons like Tom and Jerry and others, somebody is represented as being hugely brainy, like the rocket scientist, mad scientist. He has a huge head on a small body, or the idiot giant who has a tiny head on the huge body. So, if somebody has small spirit, small stature, you think that's the way you think of them for one reason or another. You draw them small compared to the populations of others within the cartoon. It just so happens that. It's the way I had always thought of John Howard. Yes.
That was the one I was thinking of too. No, it's just gone. It was the little John Howard in the barber shop. Yeah.
And by coincidence, it's the way that every cartoonist in the country saw him.
Yeah.
They detected something about the man that he had a smallness of spirit.
Yeah.
That there was.
Because he wasn't tiny.
Well, I remember once talking to Jeanette Howard at a function years ago. I think this is when John Howard was. In opposition, on the opposition front bench, I think back in the Hewson days, and Jeanette Howard said, oh, you know, you cartoonist, she said, why do you always draw my husband so short? You know that he's taller than Bob Hawke, which he was. And I remember thinking, lips don't unpurse. How can I explain? Where do I start?
Well, that was a very good explanation. It's a pity Mrs. Howard wasn't here because you gave us a very good understanding. The person you like drawing the most, is that possible?
I always liked drawing Hawk. He had a... There was a time when everybody was walking around the Canberra Times newsroom when Max Gillies was at the height of his fame. The reason I liked Hawke was that he had a whole plethora of features, any one of which you could have hung a caricature on. He had the eyebrows that were arched. He had the great bouffant of silver hair, the squeezed up lower features which gave him, you know, the down curved mouth. All these, you could have used any one of those.
Mm.
In fact, you could have just drawn the eyebrows, the nose and the mouth and even left the hair off and people would have known. that you're drawing Hawk.
Mm, mm, mm.
And Howard, in that same way, his template, his model, became simplified and even more simplified. In the end, he sort of became a round ball with a fringe of hair, eyebrows, and a lip stuck out. And that was basically it.
Attractive features.
Yes. Yeah.
So 30 years, 365 cartoons a year. Well, no, you used to take holidays, I suppose.
Yes, but I used to double up on occasions and do pockets and
what they call the small ones. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. There must be just thousands and thousands of cartoons that you've done.
Mm-hmm.
Which is your favourite?
I somehow knew this was going to be. But my favourite cartoon, I think, was the one I drew on February the 28th, 2008, my last day.
Do you miss it?
I don't miss the daily grind, not at all. I've often thought that when I see the government now doing its bit, the thought of following Wayne Swan around and trying to pin him down, it just appalls me.
It should be said that earlier in the year, Jeffrey and I flew to New York and then with a friend sailed back from New York to Sydney on a container ship, and every morning after breakfast Jeffrey would come out with his sketchbook ready to do the day's drawing.
I haven't forgotten that.
You obviously still love drawing.
Yes, I do.
Yeah.
That was the best part of the whole deal. My day for 30 years could be divided into two parts, BI and PI. And BI was before idea,
yep,
which was tortuous. Well, it could happen in the shower in the morning, which meant that, I was on holiday for the rest of the day. Or it could take all day, almost up to the time when I had to start worrying about deadline pressures. But once I had developed the idea, and it was always a sort of an image in my mind, I knew what the metaphor was going to be, then the lead helmet would lift and I'd be into PI, which is post-idea mode. And that was the technical problem of drawing it and solving it on the sheet of drawing board. And that was fun. That was the best part of the day. That presented no fears. It was the fear of finding the right idea. That was the hard part.
Yeah.
And that was the part that
and
I...
So that's where the pressure's not... That pressure's not there anymore.
No.
Yeah. So I don't need to ask you why you retired.
I thought 30 years was quite long enough.
I think 30 years is a very good innings. Are there any questions from people who wish to join into the conversation? Yes, sir. Good. Thanks.
Just following on from that last little bit... Did you ever have a day where there was no idea? And I wonder if there was a cartoon about nothing happened today possibility.
There were days when nothing happened. There used to be times before we moved into an age of election campaigns that never end. Thank you, Mr. John Howard. But there were times when the politicians would all leave in the winter recess and they would migrate like geese to the Northern Hemisphere, which is a funny thing to do because the Northern Hemisphere politicians would migrate in other directions. So one only can suppose what they were going to see. But those were days when, there was very little happening, but the space still had to be filled. I could never go into the editor's office and say, well, sorry, but nothing's happening today. I'll have to leave a blank. There will always have to be a drawing done. And this was imposed from within and from without. It was a matter of pride, personal pride, to always find that idea, as well as the system, the newspaper, the editor requiring it. And I remember some days, in those dog days, when nothing happening, and going back a few decades now, And then something would always happen, and it could happen in the form of a voice saying, well, don't you worry about that, because the little bloke across the border would always come up with something. He was a cartoonist's mate.
The comment has already been made in relation to the cartoon and don't always get them. And what I would like to ask is that in relation to the comment that you make on the cartoon in itself is powerful, but you add words to the cartoon. Yes. Now, are they for the purpose of impact or are they for the benefit of those who otherwise wouldn't get them?
Well, there may be a little part of the second, but I noticed early in the piece I started to over-caption my drawings and I had to think about the words I was going to put in them. The best cartoons would be the ones that required no caption, but there were some that needed a little bit of explaining through dialogue, and I tried to teach myself over years to keep it snappy and to try and choose words which I can imagine the subject using themselves. One of the tricks of that was, I remember Larry Pickering telling me early in the piece, I was talking to him on the phone, and he suggested that you always put the cartoon in a bubble within the drawing, and where that bubble went was part of the composition, and I had to work that out as I was drawing it, where I wanted the caption bubbles to go. And the reason for that was that if the captions were written underneath, as sometimes been the case, the editor might think he could second-guess the cartoonist and provide a funnier one and replace it. And if it's in the drawing, he couldn't. It's there. The other aspect of that too, there's a way of for people who aren't confident of the issues that they're describing or their choice of issue. It's more traditional, and you don't see it very often these days, but to have a little rag out of the news story just in the corner of the cartoon, which describes what the context of the cartoon is about. And I'd always believe that if you had to do that for the reader, then it was involving an issue which wasn't worth commenting on. You know, the issue would stand up on its own feet.
Wondered if in your retirement you're thinking of doing a book of uncensored cartoons, indulging yourself. The other thing is, do you ever do any other painting, portraiture or anything else?
I try.
Drawing?
I try. I do a little bit of painting, not enough, but it's something that interests me. I have to unlearn quite a few things. One of the problems in that respect is when you work as a cartoonist on a newspaper, you have a start to finish time of about 2 hours. That's the turnaround, you know, from the time you get the idea to the time you finish. You've got to work quickly and you've got to have a complete piece of work within that time. And it's sort of got to be... it's got to be, you can't afford to mess it up. You often don't have the time to turn around and start again because you've made a mistake. That's why whiteout is the cartoonist's best friend. The conservationists hate it, but the cartoonists love it. So when I'm painting, I have to get used to the idea that I've got time, that I don't have a deadline, I don't have to rush, and I can make a mess. And I was at the Rolf Harris talk at the Portrait Gallery last Saturday night. And he made a very interesting point. He said, it's important if somebody has artistic talent to start off when they're very young, because the word failure has no meaning. It's when you pick it up in middle age, that's when you start to worry about cocking up and making messes. And making a mess of it.
Oh, yes, I see what you mean.
And you have a fear of failure. And this is something that has to be overcome, that it doesn't matter. And this is something that I'm working on myself, that it doesn't matter, and I can just fiddle away. Because it's always been an expectation. I have done a little bit of extension drawing or life drawing and extension classes at the art school from time to time. And I always found them unsatisfactory, not least because the people, other people there had expectations about what I'd be able to do, which I didn't want to know about. I just wanted to do my thing.
Listen, if you'll indulge me for half a second, I used to hugely enjoy the howls of rage that accompanied the Tanberg top hats. Did you ever have a similar experience?
With Sir John?
Yes.
Yes. No, I think once a cartoonist picks on a prop like that, it's his. Very, very difficult to adopt it without...
But you didn't have another one, something that got howls of rage for days?
Not for Kerr himself, no. But I adopted the Sun King look for Keating because that seemed appropriate, and the periwig, which grew more and more outrageous. But there's a problem with these sorts of props, and I think Bill Leake had it with Kevin Rudd to some extent. You become tired of it. And you suspect that the readers may be becoming tired of it. And so you've got to think of a way of getting them back into mufti, you know, back into street.
Did you drop the Sun King with Keating?
Yes.
Yeah, because it began to annoy me, I must say. You know, because, you know, he clearly was one of Australia's greatest prime ministers ever. And it just seemed to me you were a bit hard on him.
Well, I just... sensed that I was getting sick of it, and I just needed to get away. And then I had to choose the right occasion to get him back into a normal suit.
And what was it? Do you remember?
I don't, not offhand, but it was one that
allowed it.
Say, yeah, allowed it.
Yeah.
But at the same time, whenever he became outrageous again, I could always keep him in his suit, but put the wig on top of him.
Yes, there we are.
I'm curious about the balance between the comic and, for want of another word, righteousness. You know, when you've got an idea, or perhaps you have two ideas, and one is just, Christ, that's funny, and the other one is, that'll fix them. You know, you've had some sense of decency or justice offended, and you can... Get your own back or something. Set it right. Which wins?
That's a good question. I always wanted. I set out consciously for the reader to enjoy the drawing, and I worked hard at setting up a scenario with people doing things which would ridicule them. And I always thought that I was blessed with this space where I was free to do whatever sort of satirical response to the day's events that I liked. I had license. And I always thought that ridicule was the main armour, the main weapon in my armoury. I don't remember ever... feeling, having a sense of sort of we'll get them, except in certain circumstances. I remember at the time of the Tampa election, and particularly the Children Overboard, where that feeling got so strong that I got stressed that I was growing angry in myself, and that was something that I didn't need to cope with. So. I saw that one through because the election happened and I was able to settle down to a new political circumstance, but that was made me quite angry. But it's, yes, that balance, it's something that I've never really thought about in that way so much, but it's a very good question.
Oh, there's one last question. Oh, Freya, I'm sorry, it's going to be a long run, so I'll fill in while you're running over there. Isn't she very good at the job, though? I mean,
Sorry, I was just going to ask you, you said that sometimes you used to have an idea while you're in the shower or whatnot, but given that you had to come up with something every day, how much time did you actually have to spend keeping up with the news, you know, current affairs and whatnot, to get these ideas in the first place?
Current affairs, they talk about the tide of events in people's lives, and current affairs are like a marine tide. Have to keep up with it all the time. It was difficult to be away, absent from it, be on holidays and have to get the wheel turning and get up to knowledge again when I got back and back to work. I can remember some days where there was so much happening. There were events happening in all directions. It was like shooting rabbits in a paddock, you know, in the old days where you'd be aiming at a rabbit here and then another one over there, and they'd be running everywhere, and in the end you'd finish up getting nothing. There'd be so many events. Which one will I choose? Which one will I choose? And this would be sort of become a worrying process. You know, you'd be cursed with an overload. And then you'd say, OK, I'll better rationalise this. I'll choose what I think is the strongest issue, comment on that. And then the next day I'll choose issue B, and then the next day, the day after that, I'll choose issue C, and then before you know where you are, you've got the whole week planned. So you draw issue A as you originally intended, and then that night when you go home, something funny happens. The tide goes out. And all those other issues have gone. During the night, they've lost all relevance. They've lost all the zing and the strength that they had the previous day, and you're left scratching your head again. It's an amazing thing. So when I say it's this sort of tide of events, it can be a full flood, or you can be stranded on the mud flats, looking around.
That's the title of your biography, Jeffrey.
That's right.
Stranded on the mud flats.
As you can see, I speak a lot in metaphors. Which is what cartooning was about a lot, you know. I was always thinking of metaphors, mental images. In fact, it was commenting on politics using visual metaphors. So that's one way of describing the process. Mm.
Well, as I said at the start, it must be really satisfying to look back on a 30-year career knowing that you've given people a lot of pleasure and a lot of laughs over a long period of time. And I'm delighted to have had the opportunity of a conversation with you this afternoon in entirely natural surroundings.
Yes.
So would you join with me in thanking Jeffrey Pryor?
Thank you very much.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.